From 90.1 WFYI Public Radio, welcome to The Art of the Matter, made possible by the ongoing support of listeners like you, and from the Palladium at the Center for the Performing Arts. The music for today's show is courtesy of the Buscelli Wallerab Jazz Orchestra from their Heart and Soul album, available on iTunes.
Welcome to The Art of the Matter. I'm Sharon Gamble. On this week's program, a one-woman show about pioneering naturalist Jean Stratton Porter. And we'll examine the career path of a guy who started out with a political science degree and ended up as the IMA's director of festivals. And don't forget, we'll have that arts calendar we call What'll We Do? All that and more after the latest news from NPR. Welcome back to The Art of the Matter from 90.1 WFYI Public Radio. I'm Sharon Gamble. On today's show, we'll meet a teen poet who wants you to go to your library right now. But first, one of the most distinctive buildings in Broad Ripple, the Vogue Theater, opened as a movie house in 1938. In 1977, it reopened as a nightclub, and today it's an icon of the neighborhood and one of Indianapolis's most popular concert venues. For 40 years, it's hosted some of the biggest names in music like Johnny Cash, the Ramones, the Flaming Lips, and Bo Diddley. Contributor Ben Schein gets all the backstage wisdom from Steve Ross, who has owned the Vogue since 1987.
Steve, let's start at the very beginning. Can you give us a little history of the Vogue?
History of the Vogue. Okay. Go way back, June 18th, 1938. It was built by Carl Nisi. He was the Midwest Fox movie theater manager. He managed all of them. And he always wanted to have his own. And he found a sponsor and built the Vogue as it is today. And, well, it had seats, had 900 seats, and had no balcony. And he ran it for 18 years until he sold it. Then it became a different types of houses. It was a porno theater right. for a few months. And the reason the Vogue lost its popularity as a movie theater was because, the general cinemas and the big AMCs took right. over. They couldn't compete. One movie theater show couldn't compete with those. And in 1977, that was when my brother bought it and converted it into a nightclub.
Awesome. So your family, they grew up in Indianapolis? You grew up in Indianapolis?
No, we grew up in Washington, Indiana. And my mom had moved here and was a realtor, and she had seen that the property was for sale or lease, and she told them to, hey, look at it. Maybe you can do a nightclub. And my brother, he started with the Bluebird. He owned right. that originally. So
you owned the Bluebird first. How did you get to become a club owner? We go way back. How did you get to be a club owner from the very beginning?
So quickly, I went to college, at IU, graduated with a degree in telecom and radio and with a theater minor. And after that, I went to Chicago, worked in radio for a while, and it wasn't working. And at that time, my brother called me and said, Steve, would you like to buy the Bluebird? And I go, I don't have any money. So I talked to a friend of mine who was doing quite well in his own business. And I said, hey, you want to buy a nightclub in Bloomington? And we were both from Washington, Indiana. He said, yeah, let's do this. And, from there on, it was just a great experience and rock and roll and a lot of fun.
Now, didn't you have to go through boot camp at the Vogue under your brother's tutelage?
Yes, thank you. When I first started, my brother said, okay, before you buy the Bluebird, I want you to work at the Vogue for 6 months. So I started as a doorman, and I was a waitress for maybe one night, and that didn't work. And then I was, after that, I became a bartender, and I worked during the day doing all sorts of work, payroll, learn how to book the bands and things like that. And I loved it. I mean, I go, man, I could do this.
Club life got into your blood.
Oh, yeah. The people, the bands, the music, it was great. The hours, even though it was, like 7 p.m. until 6 a.m. most of the time, it didn't matter. I mean, I was 26, 27 years old. So
you owned the Bluebird, and you also bought Jake's in Bloomington?
Yeah. So we bought the Bluebird, then we bought the Vogue. Then we bought Jake's, then we bought the Patio, and then we also had a club in Cincinnati. And that was ill-fated due to the riots that happened there, but that's a different story.
And you bought the Vogue then in 1987
yep.
from
mm-hmm.
your brother.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And you're the sole owner since then.
When I bought it, I had a partner, but I bought him out in 2000, and I've been the sole owner since then. So,
well, since we were talking about old clubs, the patio, I have to give it a shout out.
Near and
dear to my heart.
Yeah, the patio. Yeah.
sorry.
Yeah, the patio. And, you know, I mean, I owned it when it was closed. And the reason was is because at that time, there just wasn't the market for
right.
it. Now, in today's world, I mean, look at the hi-fi. They've
right.
got it. And that was like what the patio was doing.
Right now, the new hi-fi is about almost the same exact size as the patio.
Exactly.
Was.
So, you know, so kudos to Josh and his guys. Yep. So anyway.
Well, I would say that I went to a lot of concerts at the Vogue, but I hung out at the patio.
Thank you.
Speaking of which, the Vogue is an icon not only in Broad Ripple these days, but mm-hmm. in Indianapolis.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think it's meant to the city or the neighborhood even?
Well, the biggest thing about the Vogue is we've tried to stay true to our course and create great entertainment over the years. No matter what, you know, we went from rock and roll to dance clubs for almost 10 years, almost 15 years. And then we went back to, you know, live music and rock and roll. So we've flowed and we've kept people coming to Broad Ripple.
Would you say it's ebbed more back to live music now than dance?
It's almost, yeah, I'd say 95% live music now. And,
well,
and, you know, that's where our roots started. And, you know, we see that that's what people want. They want to see the live music.
Yeah.
So yeah, it's been a huge asset to Broad Ripple and Indianapolis, I know, and the Midwest.
Right. Well, it certainly is one of the most visible parts of Broad Ripple, that's for
sure.
Yeah,
thank you.
You know, everyone thinks owning a club is parties and rock stars. What's part of the job that people don't really know about or understand about club owning?
Oh, wow. The long hours, dealing with people who are over-intoxicated, even though we try not to. That happens. Dealing with bands who might not have the best ego, or I'm sorry, too much ego, or the best attitude. That's the biggest part, you know, trying to find the right bands, trying to book the right bands, advertise them to let people know. And in today's world, it's so different. You know, when I bought the Vogue, right. it was flyers on telephone poles.
Right. How much was a ticket for your first concert at the Vogue?
I saw an old ticket for Crosby and Nash when they played there. And that was, I think, 88. And it was like $20.
Wow.
Yeah. So I was like, now what would it cost to see those guys?
Over now 40 years of owning clubs, what are some of your favorite concerts? I would have to say, just because I can,
sure.
Willie Nelson,
yes.
Guided by Voices,
right.
Cheap Trick,
wow.
TV
yeah.
on the Radio, and the Flaming Lips are my top five.
Oh, okay.
At the Vogue.
Okay. I would go with the Red Hot Chili Peppers, Mellencamp and Josh Stone played one night. That was a great show. An old band that most people don't remember is David and David.
Mm-hmm.
They had one album, Welcome to the Boomtown. To me, that was one of the best shows. I haven't seen every show, but there's been so many great shows there.
Who do you wish you could have booked, but you never could?
Who's
the one that got away or you tried and never could book?
We were actually working on Neil Young once. He was doing a solo acoustic tour of small venues. And, you know, we were in that wheelhouse to do that. And all of a sudden, he just canceled. I mean, tickets would have been, oh my God, $200 or $300 a piece, but people would have paid it.
I would have paid it.
Yeah, yeah. So.
Do you still get excited for shows after 40 years?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean.
Do you get starry-eyed?
The cool thing is that, and I always say this, I said, I don't care if there's 10 people in the show, in the room, or, you know, we're sold out. If everybody's got a smile on their face when they leave, to me, that's the bottom line.
So after 40 years, what's next?
What's next? Okay. Well, I'm working on a new event called Walk the Talk.
Right.
And we audition people from around which they have a message. We teach them and help them, you know, be a better speaker. And then we put a TED Talk-like event on at the Vogue. And we've done 5 of them right now. And the next one is Life's Purpose, which is April 19th.
What?
I'm sorry, Positive Thinking, which is April 19th. And we've got 6 unbelievable speakers. And that's what I'm working on now. And my goal is maybe take this nationwide.
TED Talks are kind of like concerts for smart people. Is that right? Or for people thinkers?
That's good, man. You're right. It's for thinkers. And our sense are based on more like spirituality and well-being. It touches a little more, you know, a little less technical as right. TED Talks does. You know, we've talked about compassion, gratitude, love in action. We've got one coming up is Life's Purpose. The next one is Positive Thinking. You know, these are all things that we all think about and wonder about. And every speaker that we have will give you takeaways to write down and think about and, you know, put into action and walk the talk.
Well, that's really great.
Thank you.
Must-see shows coming up in the next few months at the Vogue.
Let's see. Rusted Root is coming up Thursday. They're going to have Trample by Turtles drummer with them. Let's see what else. The Revolution, which I showed you the past. Right. That's, you know, the original members of Prince's band. Pokey Lafarge. Yeah, Pokey Lafarge, man. He's so cool. And, you know, just a plug for us, thevogue.com, if you want to check out all our concerts.
That's great.
It's
Steve,
great.
Thanks for coming in.
Thank you so much, Ben.
Contributor Ben Schein with Steve Ross. This year, Steve is celebrating 30 years owning and running the Vogue nightclub in Broad Ripple. For a list of upcoming concerts, visit thevogue.com. For most artists, there's a single medium singing its clarion call, saying, come work in oils, play the flute, dance ballet. But Indianapolis's Kevin Huey says he's always made things, and sometimes those things are music, sometimes they're paintings, sometimes they're food, and sometimes they're sculptures. Kevin took a break from his current art show at Clues Memorial Hall to tell me how he became a maker and why his life changed when his dad dropped off a bandsaw at his house. Kevin, you have so many artistic outlets. You're a musician.
Yes.
You work in wood.
Mm-hmm.
You work in paint.
Mm-hmm.
What was your first of those loves? And you're a photographer as well.
Probably drawing. Used to draw at my grandmother's table when she would babysit. Set a crayon, she'd give me a pencil and paper. Some of my earliest memories are drawing. Always did well in music and art, so just follow that path.
That was smart, to listen to those voices in your head.
I was lucky enough to go to Europe in junior high years, see a lot of great art. The Louvre, the Vatican, Sistine Chapel, Last Judgment, Borghese Palace, and kind of goes on and on.
I think you've just made a compelling argument for funding for the arts there and for getting kids, especially these days, away from a backlit screen and into places where they can see actual art.
I was lucky enough they asked me to be one of the adjudicators for the Scholastic Art and Creative Writing Contest.
Wow.
And I wasn't sure I wanted to do it, and my wife talked me into it. And I felt great after doing that. It was so much fun.
You felt like there's still talent coming up and people are still interested.
They gave us free tickets to Clues, and we chose the Jessica Lange Contemporary Dance Show.
Uh-huh.
It was wonderful. It was amazing. I encourage people to buy season tickets and go to Clues Hall. It's just amazing shows there.
So tell me a little bit about, so you go to see something that's in an art firm, one of the few art firms you apparently don't practice, so you see dance. So is there, does that inspiration stay with you or maybe it's at any conscious level, or do you think it stays with you at some other level?
Yeah, it does. I followed my wife's career to Hawaii, and we saw the Bolshoi do Giselle, which was actually the first time they danced with toe shoes. Hmm. And the next morning I got up and drawing dancers and painting dancers, and it's
you had no choice.
Yeah, I mean, you dream about it and wake up and do it.
You've been on I don't know if kick is the right word for it, but been on the path doing a lot with flowers. You seem to be fascinated with both painting flowers and then creating them in wood. What is it about flowers? And do you paint from nature, from photographs, or from your imagination, or all of the above?
Most of the things for sale are from photographs. And I don't want them to be photographic,
mm-hmm.
Although the early roses were pretty as realistic as I could make them.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm kind of moving away. All art goes into two categories, subjective or objective. And I knew my father would appreciate it if I did objective painting.
What was his field?
Furniture and upholstery.
Okay.
And
so he did
draperies,
real things in three dimensions.
Yeah. Interiors.
Mm-hmm. But there's something that calls to you to go beyond that. You were kind enough to bring in one of your paintings, and it's a rose, but I recognize it being a gardener as a rose, but it's also in colors that might not be realistic.
Right.
Which is fascinating to me. They're rich, hot pinks and mauves and deep bluish purple.
Yeah, I always liked the painters that the paint looked like paint.
Mm-hmm.
And whether you had to back up and look at it again or... But I like the painterly artists, and it expresses more emotion than possibly just the photograph could do by itself. If I wanted it to be super, super realistic, I'd be afraid I'd get it too tight, but why not take a photograph then? I know lots of great photographers, but I think expressing emotions and feelings mm-hmm. in the artwork.
And then with woodworking, do you start with real life or with photograph, or when you're recreating a flower in wood, how does that work?
Well, I didn't really mean to start out with a wood flower, but my dad dropped a bandsaw off at my house, and I bought some wood, and I started cutting out discs of zinnias and then putting spacers in between them and painting them and then putting them back together and touching them up again. So they're pretty large, two feet around. And
yeah, and you have very large work in this Clues show because of the space, right? And some of your canvases are, did you tell me, 4 feet?
Yeah, 3 or 4 feet. I purposely, for the show, tried to paint larger than I'm really used to. But Dr. Murphy at Ball State, she said, paint large so your detail can be large.
You can see Kevin Huey's paintings and wood sculptures at Clues Memorial Hall through June 30th, and you can learn more about his work at kevinhueyartstudio.com. Just a reminder, you're listening to The Art of the Matter on 90.1 WFYI Public Radio. I'm Sharon Gamble, and later this hour, Jean Stratton Porter was way ahead of her time. But first, Eat Drink Indie's Jolene Ketzenberger talks with Stephanie Cook Pavilonis, winemaker at Daniel's Family Vineyard and Winery.
2010, a little bit before that, during the local movement, kind of, when that started to become popular and people started to think, instead of buying from big brands, I want to buy from local, see where it's grown. He kind of got Napa inspired. He went out to Napa before that. He thought, why not plant a vineyard out here? So, Purdue, they help wineries throughout the state immensely. And so we went to them, they tested our soil, and they told us what type of varietals would be able to grow on our land. So
now, when was that?
That was, we planted 2010, so probably 2009, something.
So this has been going on for quite a while.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So we planted in 2010 those varietals they suggested.
Now, which ones can you grow here?
We have Concord, Chamberson, Noray, Vidal Blanc, Marquette, Catawba, and these are all like East Coast, more hardy grapes. We also grow Cabernet Franc, which that one is a bit harder to grow here. So people, they'll notice throughout the seasons, during the wintertime, there'll actually be hay around those plants to keep in the heat and to allow those to grow.
So you have a lot of varietals that are growing right here, mm-hmm. you know, and people have been watching. You know, I've been hearing about this for a long time. Oh, my gosh. You know, there's a vineyard going up out there. So how was it when you started? What did people think?
So I remember everyone, yes, they would drive by and they would see all these. First, they started with poles out there and they were confused. What is this? And then eventually we started hanging the wire and they were like, no way, this is a vineyard. And then they were probably thinking these people are crazy because not only did we decide to do this, but my dad was kind of has the thing on go big or go home.
So he wasn't going to do it in a small way.
No. So this is 24 acres. So last we checked, which it may be different now, we're third largest vineyard in Indiana.
Oh, my goodness. Right off the bat.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So he was kind of like, if we're going to do this, might as well try it and go for it. So then eventually people realized it was a vineyard and we were really excited about it. And at first we were just planting, harvesting, and selling off the grapes. So then with everyone being so excited, we were like, okay, maybe we'll do a grape stomp. So 2010, we did a grape stomp, and we just...
Now, what does that mean?
So, like, we did the I Love Lucy style, literally got big bins, filled them with...
really?
Yes, half a ton of grapes, took off your shoes, got in there. We told people if they wanted to dress up as I Love Lucy. And we ended up having like around 300 people. And we just did Facebook and some signs around town. And we realized, because people kept asking us, what is this? What's going on? We realized that maybe this should be something more than just planting these grapes and harvesting. And then that kind of led us into the idea of a building and moving on to a winery and a tasting room and a banquet hall. It's all kind of...
It has grown then. Yes. Oh my gosh. So you started out with the idea of just being a vineyard?
Mm-hmm. Yes. Started with that. And then we did another grape stomp in 2011. And we had around, like, I think 1,200 people.
Coming out here.
Still the same. Kind of we wanted to test the advertising. And
so, did you have the building or anything at the time?
No building.
They're just out here surrounded by the grapevines.
Mm-hmm. Yep. And we did it in the front area. So that was a treat. And we were like, okay, now we're really going to do this. So that's when we started to work on this building plan. Then we ended up having in our building a banquet hall that could hold around 325 people.
Wow. So this idea really did grow.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Because at first we were like, okay, banquet hall, what size? And we realized there's nowhere on the side of town really or around Indiana besides Indianapolis that you can have something that you could have 325 people besides downtown. So we were like, okay, let's do that. So then that took up half of our building, which I wasn't very pleased because that was meant a little bit in my production, but we still have a really good spot for that too.
Now, how did you go about gearing up and learning about this? Must have been an ongoing process as well.
Mm-hmm. So I'm actually the winemaker, and my sister and I, the first year she did it with me. I was kind of just studying and learning, and we had a consultant that first year, and we made the wine, and then the next year her and I just did it, and then the last 2 years I've just been making it. But it's just a lot of reading and learning because I didn't go to school for it.
Oh my goodness, so you are a self-taught winemaker. How cool is that?
Yes, it's a little scary, but I think, yes, it's pretty cool.
You can hear Jolene Katzenberger's Eat, Drink, Indie Saturday mornings at 11 on WFYI HD2, The Point. Libraries are so much more than repositories of books and other media. They're at the heart of community education and creativity, too, a role that the Indianapolis Public Library takes seriously. Through their annual Slammin' Rhymes Challenge, kids write based on an inspiring topic. Last year's theme was Dare to Dream. As a first-year participant, 15-year-old teen Justice Sanderson didn't expect to win, but you'll hear why his poem, This is Testament, is perfect to celebrate National Poetry Month.
I'm Justice Sanderson. I'm a freshman at Franklin Central High School here in Indianapolis, and my poem is titled This is Testament. It's inspired by the many problems that I see throughout every library. People turning away from the books and pulling up their phones, using the Wi-Fi. Why do we ignore the library? We pay attention to technology and put our minds into terminology. I'm not saying that this is doxology, but what we think is right is complete stupidity. Do you want the future of us all to be in repetition, crying and whining because you can't get a college admission? A book is knowledge and intelligence is our mission, so why leave the library when you can fix the situation? We want to corrupt ourselves in lies and spend our valuable lives behind a screen that burns our eyes and ignore everything until it's time to die. A book is a book, I guess that's what they say, but it's not wasted paper, it will not waste your day. Writers write their pain, it's the thing that keeps them sane. They try so hard to entertain, but you just can't keep it in your brain. A book has knowledge, fantasies, actions, and sometimes death. A book isn't boring, and I'm not going to waste my breath. All I'm trying to say is, don't walk away and let the time fade. Grab a book, let your brain serenade. Let the thoughts from the book blast like a grenade. Don't be like Fahrenheit 451 and let books be slayed. Don't waste the time away and let your intelligence drop. A book can help you out, and you never know when your heart could stop. All I'm trying to say is, read today and lead the way. Because what we say will never go away. Sincerely, Smiling Silence.
Justice Sanderson with This is Testament. You can see Justice perform on the Indianapolis Public Library's various digital and social media outlets. Jill, I just love this guy's energy. He's
kind of like a young Dr. Seuss with an attitude.
Yeah. And he makes it feel hip and cool to go to the library, which you believe and I believe.
Mm-hmm. But you wonder about kids his age. And so this is very... it's invigorating to hear someone like that with so much passion about the words and using actually book titles within his poetry as well.
Yeah.
Smart kid.
Smart kid. And he might grow up and be an artist and have his events featured on our calendar that we call
What'll We Do?
How's that for a smooth segue? What do you have?
Well, speaking of libraries, Irvington Library at the Irvington branch over there on East Washington Street. 'Tis the month of May, just around the corner, and they're going to be celebrating the Indy 500 with the Indy 500 Film Festival. The first lineup starts on Tuesday, May the 9th at 7 p.m. It's the Golden Festival of Speed with the young A.J. Foyt. And the Strategy for Speed and the 51st 500, all those films on May the 9th. And then again on Tuesday, May the 16th at 7 p.m., they'll be from 1977, Foyt's fourth win. And once again, you can go and relive all those exciting Indy 500 moments for free at the Irvington Library over there on East Washington Street.
And, you know, this is A.J. Foyt's time. You're going to bring us an on-site story from the A.J. Foyt exhibit at the Indianapolis Motor Speedway Museum in a couple of weeks.
We certainly are. Looking forward to that.
Neat. So for something completely different, combine orphans, tender-hearted, bloodthirsty pirates, who are all orphans, rather mediocre policemen, clever young ladies, and zany lyrics and music of Gilbert and Sullivan, and you have a delightful show, The Pirates of Penzance, if you haven't recognized it already. The Hendrick Symphony Orchestra is presenting a version of this on May 5th, that's a Friday, and May 7th, that's a Sunday, at Avon Middle School North. And you can hear all those delightful patter songs and just enjoy this the twisty story. And just a spoiler alert, everybody is happy at the end of Pirates of Penzance.
Everybody's probably happy on Friday nights in Fisher's when they run their free family movie nights in the Nickel Art Plate District right there in the heart of Fisher's. And Friday, May the 5th, the film will be The Secret Life of Pets. And I believe the week after is Cinderella. So every Friday night, it's a family-friendly film, and it's free starting at 7 p.m. in Fisher's.
You know, we are accustomed to saying, hey, let's go out for First Friday gallery walks in downtown Indy. Well, Broad Ripple, not to be outdone, is having a second Friday event on May 12th. It is a an art walk with 15 destinations, and your hint is to look for groovy shoes outside the doors to find art, refreshments, and good company inside. I think the connection is shoes, you know, for walking. But perfect time to go out and check out some art in Broad Ripple.
And First Friday, as we mentioned here, May the 5th at the Full Circle Gallery over there in the Circle City Industrial Complex in the South Studios from 6 to 9 p.m., Jeannie Dill will be showing her Inked Up work. It's all done in ink, and it's she's dedicating this to her granddaughter Haley, who is on the autism spectrum. And her work, she says, when she works in ink, it kind of reflects the emotional ups and downs that her granddaughter goes through. And also, when you're over there at Circle City Industrial Complex, if you go up into the North Studios, Satch has her studios there that are open. Nancy Lee with her fabulous jewelry. Casey Roberts has his studios open there, and dozens and dozens of more. There's free parking 6 to 9 p.m. the first Friday at the Circle City Industrial Complex.
Now, this is not an invitation for somebody to deliver a dog to my door. I am currently without a dog, and I would love to have a Cavalier King Charles Spaniel someday. But I have been having a good time with the Dogs Faithful and True exhibit at the Idlejorg. And if you're a dog lover, you owe it to yourself to not only check out the exhibition, but some of the programming that's coming up. For example, on Friday, May 12th from 1 to 2, there's a pet portrait workshop with artist Sheila Jackson, who happens to be on the administrative staff there, but she's a visual artist first and foremost, and she's going to teach you acrylic painting techniques, and you're going to probably bring a photo or two of your furry friend, and by the end of the workshop, you're going to have a portrait of your canine companion.
May the 6th, the Jazz Kitchen. Regina Carter, the blues jazz vocalist, will celebrate Ella Fitzgerald's 100th birthday. Several shows that night at the Jazz Kitchen over there on 54th and College.
The play starts in 1979. It spans three decades and six presidential administrations, and it centers around a woman who throws Georgetown dinner parties that might change the course of Washington's politics. It's called The City of Conversation. It's on stage at Theater on the Square just through this Saturday. So act quickly to get a ticket, and what a timely topic.
Indie Convergence is holding its first River West Art Walk on Friday, May the 12th from 6 to 9 p.m. They're located at 2611 West Michigan Street, just west of the IUPUI campus.
You can learn lots more about local arts events in our community at indiearts.org/guide, the Arts Council of Indianapolis's Indie Arts Guide, or join us again next week for that calendar we call
What'll We Do?
You're listening to The Art of the Matter, a weekly show about the arts in Indianapolis and central Indiana. Your host is Sharon Gamble. If your arts organization has an event or activity of which you think we should be aware, please contact us at least 3 weeks in advance. You can write us at The Art of the Matter, care of WFYI, 1630 North Meridian Street, Indianapolis, Indiana, 46202, or you can email us at aotm@wfyi.org. You can also hear The Art of the Matter on WFYI.org.
You're listening to The Art of the Matter on 90.1 WFYI Public Radio. I'm Sharon Gamble, and in just a bit, the IMA has a new key staff member who wants to change how you use the museum's campus. But right now, Gene Stratton Porter was a pioneering Indiana naturalist long before we'd coined that term, and she was also a writer of fiction. Indy's Glory June Greif is touring her one-woman show about Stratton Porter around the state, and she wants you to know about more than just the author's most famous title, A Girl of the Limberlost. How did you get interested in Gene Stratton Porter?
Well, that's an interesting question. Not the way people usually do. I think I read one or two of her books when I was young. I had my
The novels.
And I had my grandmother's copy of Laddie in tattered shape, so I did. I know I read that.
Aww.
But what happened was way back in the 80s sometime, I think it was, the State Museum had an exhibit of her photographs, and they were so exquisite. And I do photography. Mm-hmm. And I saw, you can't even reproduce some of these photographs today because they were acquired with the old cameras with the glass plates.
Sure.
And she was right literally on top of the birds.
Mm.
She had such patience, and she worked so slowly and carefully that the birds trusted her. So she has exquisite photos of nesting birds, of the parent birds feeding them, that kind of thing. I was just stunned. And so I went from there. And then what happened was about 8 years ago, there was an anniversary of the publication of A Girl of the Limberlost, and the Indiana Historical Society knew that I did first-person interpretations occasionally. They asked, about 3 weeks before the event, asked if I would.
Oh, gracious. That's
yes.
Not much lead time.
No, it wasn't. And they asked if I would do Gene Stratton Porter. So I did a really slam-bam well into the night read, and I got through almost all her novels and, of course, researched her life. And I did the first appearance in the Irvington Library, and there were 125 people.
Wow.
Yeah, it was intimidating, but it worked very well, and ever since, here I am.
So I don't want to give up away too much about her life for people who are going to come see and hear your performance. But, you know, when you're telling somebody's life story, you have to figure out is your persona fixed in time? Are you the person at the end of her life looking back and telling stories about her life? Or are you going to change eras? What was your window into her life? What is your how do you frame it?
Well, I bring people back into approximately 1920, 21. And as I do more research, I can take her almost to the end of her life. She was killed at a rather young age, I think. We won't get into that. But I despise questions like, how did you die, Mrs.
Mm-hmm,
Porter?
Sure.
That just doesn't work for me. I know other interpreters may choose to do it differently. But I do all I can to bring them back in time. And part of the way I achieve that is I give my introducer some material to let them know, now we are going back in time. I just recently did a program up at Pokagon State Park, and the naturalist up there said, there were a lot of children in the audience, and says, now we are going into our time machine. And she made time machine noises.
Clever.
But it got the job across. You know, we are going back in time. Mm-hmm. And that way I could answer questions as Gene Stratton Porter, because I do open it up for a few questions afterwards. And then if there are questions that can only be answered by somebody who's researched her, then I step away and go out of character, and then I'll answer those too.
Sure. One of the things that, you know, if we stop 10 people on the street, we'll be lucky if some of them have heard of her.
And alas, yes.
And her name is kind of synonymous with A Girl of the Limberlost, but that was only one of a dozen novels.
Yes.
And as I understand it, tell me if this is true, she mostly wrote the novels to support her habit as a naturalist. She
yes.
loved being a naturalist.
She was indeed a wonderful naturalist, and her mission, as it were, was to do the naturalist work, discover new things, write about habits, mostly birds, but also butterflies and moths and such like, and write about them for the general public so they could be introduced to nature and learn to love it. And she called it sugarcoating. So she would introduce a lot of this knowledge into her novels, and people would be learning all about the moths and birds and so forth, not realizing it as they were devouring the novel. And then she alternated the novels with nonfiction. Plus, oh my goodness, she had so many magazine columns going on. She was really a voice for conservation. And, of course, that's my link to her. She was a very early environmentalist and is largely forgotten as such.
Your next chance to see Glory June Greif's one-woman show, A Visit from Gene Stratton Porter, is Sunday, May 14th in the Visitor Center Amphitheater at Mound State Park. Glory June brings Miss Stratton Porter to Turkey Run State Park on Friday, June 9th as well. And if you catch the Stratton Porter bug, visit her state historic site in Rome City. The Indianapolis Museum of Art has hired a new events planner, a key curator-level position in the changing world of art museums. I met Jeremy Shubrook, the IMA's new director of festivals, performance, and public programs, a couple of weeks after he moved to town in February, and he'd already delved deeply into our city's arts and culture scene. I invited him to tell us how someone ends up with a gig like his new job. So inquiring minds want to know, how does a person grow up to become a director of festivals, performance, and public programs?
It's interesting that you say that, because my background isn't in performing arts initially. I actually have a political science degree. But I found myself going to the Cleveland Museum of Art. I was in Cleveland, Ohio in my 20s. And I found myself going to the Cleveland Museum of Art in all my spare time.
What was the attraction?
I was working in a greenhouse, which is funny. I was working in a greenhouse, and I decided that I needed more art in my life, and I would go to the Cleveland Museum of Art. I spent a lot of time in the Asian galleries, and I would typically go there on my days off, and I saw a posting for a front-of-house greeter, and this was in 1997. Mm-hmm. Found a position for a front-of-house greeter. I applied. I got it. I left the greenhouse, and I was at the museum for 10 years after that in different
wow.
positions. And ultimately, I moved from front-of-house greeter to security, to education, to performing arts, music, and film over the course of 10 years.
That's a twisty path.
It was.
But I feel as though there was another chapter in between political science and working at the Cleveland Museum of Art. You were in Europe for a while.
That's correct. So after I finished university, I found myself with this idea of I wasn't quite sure that I wanted to be in politics, really. I had done a brief internship at the State House in Austin, Texas, where I was going to school, and it really kind of put a bad taste in my mouth. So I just didn't like the backdoor dealings and all of that, honestly. And I won't say who I was working with.
No, please don't.
Yes. But it just, there was something about the whole scenario there that didn't work for me.
Yeah.
So I wanted to go into the Peace Corps. Nobody really wanted a German-speaking liberal arts major in the Peace Corps at the time.
Oh, that's so sad.
So I found another organization called Volunteers for Peace, and I lined up a six-month series of volunteer positions from the Czech Republic, Germany, the Netherlands, and Northern Ireland over the course of 6 months. And it was at that point that I started feeling kind of more involved in the arts, and I knew that I didn't want to be in politics anymore. Mm-hmm. So I came back to the U.S. after all of that with a completely different mindset, and I knew that whatever I was going to do with my life, I would have to love it. It wouldn't be necessarily about the money. It would be about the love of the work itself.
What did you learn abroad that led you to that conclusion?
You know, when you go to countries that are older than ours, you learn an appreciation for the historic culture and surely the arts in some of these countries where the arts are funded by the governments and all that. But if you go to some of the older cities like Prague and Dresden, well, Dresden obviously completely redone, but nonetheless where there's amazing performance venues, there's amazing visual arts venues, It started expanding my horizons. Mm-hmm. So I saw film that I hadn't seen before, or wasn't exposed before. I saw musical performances in venues like churches that I hadn't had a chance to see before. Mm. And all of that started opening up my horizons.
So tell me if this is a true statement. You're not a musician particularly?
No.
You're not a painter?
No.
Are you a writer?
I am.
Okay. All right. There we go.
So I have done some creative writing in my time. I've published one short story. And this was some years ago, and I've published some poetry over the years.
Okay.
But I don't actively write now, but I have a cache of things that I've written that I'd like to go back and visit someday.
So you're actually quite typical of a lot of people who work largely behind the scenes. When you say the arts, everybody pictures someone with a paintbrush in hand, someone with a musical instrument in hand, someone executing dance moves. But there's this whole subculture that you're a part of, the people behind the scenes who organize the artists to produce the works, but who maybe have a secret life as an artist themselves.
That's correct. It's funny. I saw a graph the other day that was an iceberg, and it showed, you know, the top third of the iceberg above water, and that was the performance. Mm-hmm. And the bottom two-thirds of the iceberg was everything leading up to the performance. That was the part that was underwater. So that's the behind-the-scenes analogy that I can think of.
Boy, you really enacted that two-thirds of the iceberg for your job in Miami. Tell us about that job. I want you to say the title, but then explain what that title means.
Sure. I actually started as a technical director at mm-hmm. the Adrian Arsch Center for the Performing Arts in Miami. And what I was doing is I was the on-the-ground logistician, if you will, to execute all of the technical details of a performance. So oftentimes the programming department would pick a performance, and it's going to various venues around the country and maybe around the world. And the job of the technical director is to see how that performance fits in our venue. And in the case of the Arsch Center, we had three theaters proper, but a total of eight different spaces that we presented performances. And so I did that for a number of years for corporate dinners, galas, cocktail parties, and then the full range of performance, dance, music, performance art, theater, opera, ballet. So over the course of, you know, let's say 3.5 years, I touched every aspect of the performing arts world from a logistical standpoint. And then at that point, I became the director of production for the Arsch Center. And so my last few years there, I oversaw that entire division of production. So the folks that were the technical directors that remained were all the people. And it was almost like I was overseeing their whole process. So I needed to know everything that was going on, but maybe not the level of detail that each of them did with each of their performances and events. But there were five technical directors at the time when I was running the department. And it was just keeping them moving and keeping all the budgets in order and making sure the building was kept in good shape. All the theaters were, you know, managed. We called it keep it like new. We'd like to keep all of our theaters in like tip-top shape, even though we were already a new venue.
But both of those jobs you've just described are the kind where if you do your job right, nobody notices?
That's correct.
If you mess up?
That's correct.
Yeah.
You often don't want anybody to know that you're there. So we always say that if you haven't heard anything at the end of a performance, you've actually had a good show. So. But I've seen the opposite. I've seen a show where something does happen, and that's, you know, that puts everybody very quickly in action. And there's a very big difference between live theater and, you know, like the world of film or TV, for example.
And all you hear in the lobby afterwards is, I couldn't hear a word, or, the acoustics were terrible.
Yes, and I've had several conversations with members of the public because it was my job to be accountable for all of that. If something wasn't right, to kind of explain what we may have gone through that particular day, evening, whatever. But oftentimes it was something that we could fix.
Yeah.
So,
what's the attraction of this job?
You know, I had been missing You know, when I worked at the Cleveland Museum of Art in performing arts, I was much closer to the actual art of it, you know, getting to know the performers, interacting with them on all levels from, you know, what the program was about, you know, what it took to execute the program, the audience experience. I was involved in all levels there because it was a smaller program than obviously than I worked at the Performing Arts Center. We had one theater at the Cleveland Museum of Art. But in Miami, there was so much going on. There was 500 performances and events a year. So you don't really get to touch those personally that often. There were surely things that I did. There were a handful of performances over the years that I was very personally involved with by nature of the level of production, the accountability of the budget, or because I was invested in the performance part from the planning phase. But here, the attraction is that there's such a diverse campus. There's so many different places that we have options to present performances, events, family programs, and rethinking that palette of what we can do, maybe what's been done, what hasn't been done for some time, and just really trying to explore my creative side again, which I feel like I've only done in one direction, and now this opens up into different directions.
Jeremy Shubrook is the IMA's new Director of Festivals, Performance, and Public Programs. Next up, a cultural manifesto. Every week, a cultural manifesto's Kyle Long talks five songs with someone from our community. Here's this week's journey.
I'm Kyle Long from Cultural Manifesto. I'm here with Richard Edwards. As most of our listeners know, Richard is the founder, frontman, and songwriter of Margo and the Nuclear So-and-Sos. But Richard's latest project is Lemon Cotton Candy Sunset, his first post-Margo solo record, and it's available now on Joyful Noise Recordings. It's an amazing record, Richard. Thank you for being here.
Thank you very much.
And you have five songs to share with us today.
Okay.
Yeah. Do you have them picked out and ready? I put you on the spot with this, so I know these are all coming off straight off the cuff.
Okay, I'll try to think of them as I'm naming them.
Yeah.
Well, the first one would be a Randy Newman song called Texas Girl at the Funeral of Her Father, which I just think is, you know, if there's such a thing as perfect art, that's a perfect song. It's perfectly written, and it's a song that for whatever reason, even though it's sort of a drag, and you'd think if you're already feeling sick and bummed out, it wouldn't help, but it did help like crazy. I would listen to it late at night, and yeah, it was just always really moving. I didn't do it every single night, but, you know, once a week I would listen to it. And it's just kind of the pinnacle of a guy who's, like, on my personal Mount Rushmore, I guess, of songwriters.
Yeah, I am lost in the wind, round in circles sailing.
The second one would be equally kind of like Bummer City, which would be You're a Big Girl Now, and specifically the New York version of it, not to be too hoity-toity, by Bob Dylan, which was another song that just felt, you know, he's one of those people that can write songs that are so good that they feel like they're in your head, if your head was bigger and better and smarter. And
you made it there somehow. You're a big girl now.
So I have a daughter who listens to a lot of music, and her taste is, some would say, evolving. She was listening to a Taylor Swift record maybe a year ago, and there's a song called Blank Space that was on this Taylor Swift record that I love. That is great. Another kind of like perfectly written pop song.
Number four.
There is an L.A., she was an L.A. songwriter, I think maybe she's New Orleans now, Ricky Lee Jones, which is probably a big name for most people. I didn't know it that well. She had a song called Skeletons on this record. It was on Pirates. But yeah, it's this beautiful song about an inner city kid getting, you know, shot, but it's beautiful and gorgeous. And I was listening to it in Los Angeles where I was consciously and unconsciously listening to a lot of like LA music, I guess, or music that felt like Los Angeles to me.
Fifth and final song,
my
Richard Edwards.
Final song would be, I had a friend who I think was a tour manager for this guy, Father John Misty. I didn't know that music very well at all, probably just out of like stubbornness and refusal to listen to something that everyone around me liked. And at some point I found that record and it was really surprising and I enjoyed it a lot more than maybe I thought I would. And the first song on, I think it's his first record, it's called a song called Fun Times in Babylon, I think it's called. And he's just writing about, I guess it's about, like, he's going to go to Hollywood and just kind of, like, get it on, you know. He's going to just, like, party and meet women and think about women he's known. But it's like, he sounds so bummed that he's about to have all that fun.
Richard, your new album is titled Lemon Cotton Candy Sunset. It's available now on Joyful Noise Recordings. It's available in digital format and, of course, on vinyl. Joyful Noise always has great vinyl pressings. Anything you want to say to folks about this record before we wrap it up?
Nah.
Well, I'll play a sample as we go out here and let the music speak for itself. Thank you so much, Richard.
Thank
Appreciate
you.
It.
Yeah, it was a pleasure.
From Logan Square Station. Come to see me down in the ghetto and I'll break my brain all
over you again. Here, Kyle's A Cultural Manifesto on 90.1 WFYI Public Radio, Wednesday nights at 9 or Saturday nights at 10. Thanks for listening to The Art of the Matter on 90.1 WFYI Public Radio. I'm Sharon Gamble, and today's contributors included Ben Schein. Hear The Art of the Matter Saturday mornings at 7 or join us Thursday nights at 8. And remember, you can always listen to and share our podcast at WFYI.org. Next week, two fests for your feasting, Onyx Fest and the Virginia Avenue Folk Fest. We'll also meet a local fashion designer and hear about a turn of the 20th century private train car that feels like a Victorian mansion inside. And of course, we'll have that arts calendar we call
What'll We Do?
All of that and so much more on The Art of the Matter here on 90.1 WFYI Public Radio.
You've been listening to The Art of the Matter, a weekly show about the arts in Central Indiana and Indianapolis. The Art of the Matter is executive producer Roxana Caldwell, producer Melissa Davis, contributor Jill Dittmeyer, and host Sharon Gamble. The Art of the Matter, made possible by the ongoing support of listeners like you.